You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
Thursday here today. It's going to be up around 70 degrees. Unreal. All we have left now is just a couple sparse little patches of not even half an inch thick of snow left by another hour or two as the sun comes up a little higher. That'll be gone. Goodbye, good riddance. But, you know, New England is so crazy. It's like our politicians in Washington, those schizophrenic, that can change any moment. We could still get whacked with another major friggin' dumpage of snow. Anyway. Let's see here. We got a couple of updates. Again, They're coming out daily now. Before, things were coming out, you know, every few days or once a week or twice a week, whatever. Now it's constant. This thing is just snowballing, baby. Yep. I love it. The alternative media, several YouTubers have been commenting that the alternative media is moving forward now and just crushing mainstream media. I didn't think I'd ever see that day. And, this is obviously the reason why we're seeing measures taken, and this is only going to increase to shut down. They're going to have to stage something, guys, to shut down alternative media. I mean, you know, YouTube, et al., they're doing their job on the net, shutting down YouTubers, taking down their pages and whatnot for various sleazy reasons, you know, nefarious reasons, not really telling you what the real reason is. It's obvious what they're doing, but it's not enough, because every time they take one down, 10 more rise up to take their place. Not just YouTube, you know, lots of social media. People are getting the word out. And this thing is growing by leaps and bounds. And they know it. So much so that the mainstream media itself can't ignore this. But they're addressing it, you know, to poo-poo it, to laugh, to make fun of it, to label it as fake news, you know, conspiracy nuts, blah, 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 the usual rhetoric. But it's just not working. Despite all of their attempts to water it down and to neutralize it, it's still growing by leaps and bounds. Again, so much so that they can't ignore it, try as they may. And it's making our wonderful good old boys over at the FBI, look like the scoundrels that they are. The fact that they're not doing anything about, you know, Pizzagate, for example, which is so obvious, guys. The evidence is so freaking unbelievable. Once people are confronted with it and they realize that the director himself said that he's not going to pursue this. I you got to be freaking kidding me. You know, it's like finding out about a murder scene where hundreds of witnesses said they saw, you know, Mr. Smith leave the scene, and then you find, you know, his cigarette butts lying all over the place with his DNA on them, and you can see his DNA in the fingernails of the victim, you know, on and on and on. His car was found all bloody with the victim's blood all over it. A trail of blood leading, you know, from his car to his front door, on and on and on and on. And yet the police say, well, we're not going to pursue this. And you find out, oh, he's related to the town selectmen. I mean, that's what we're dealing with here. So let them continue to ignore this. Because more and more people are finding out about this, looking into this, and when they discover this, and then they see the FBI's deliberate complacency about it. They're worse than complacent. They're covering it up, collecting evidence, and having it disappear. All they got to do from there is start looking into other major fiascos that have gone on over the decades. You know, 9/11, et al. And see the lies, the cover-up, the collection of evidence that disappeared. You know, it's time for a grand, grand awakening. I love it. A listener sent me a clip yesterday. I don't know. Actually, I do know. It was from CNN because it was Wolf Blitzer that was interviewing Podesta. I think this was a while back. Yeah, because the campaign was still underway. He was talking about Hillary, you know. And the polls and everything. But anyway, I wasn't so much listening to what that little scumbag was saying. I was listening to what was going on in the background. Because all the while he's talking to Wolfie Boy, you can hear people screaming in the background, hey, Podesta, why don't you talk about your emails? Woo! The whole time that they're talking. Protesters are in the background screaming and holding up placards. Wow. Oh, baby. It was freaking classic. And they're, you know, you could tell they're turning blue in the face, but there's nothing they could do. So they just ignored it. But you could tell it was severely distracting them. They had all they could do to try to concentrate on what they were supposed to be talking about. Oh, yeah, it was great, man. That was freaking awesome. Kudos to everybody that was there at that protest. That was freaking awesome, man. You could tell, oh, boy, did they want to call in their minions and have them open fire on them? Oh, did they ever want to do that? Guys, I shudder to think about it, but I'm telling you now, we're heading for that in this country. We're heading for that probably sooner than you care to know. They're going to do it, guys. They're going to do it. That's the only way they're going to be able to shut people up, whip them into submission. They're not going to get their Jew world order in place peacefully. It's not going to happen. They wanted it to be that way. Oh, and they made a lot of accomplishments, didn't they, to dumb people down, you know, get them on the Prozac and the Ritalin and toxify their brains with, you know, nonsensical frickin', real fake news. Oh, yeah. They've done a good job. But you know what? Even the dumbest among them, even the most doped up among them, if they just take half a second, they can clearly see that because they're so out of control in their lust and pursuit for power. You can't miss it, even when you're on frickin' Prozac and Ritalin. You can't miss it. So they're going to have to crack down. They're going to stage something to make it look like it's necessary. We have to do this to bring peace back to the streets. But they're going to get so blatant, as power mongers have always done throughout the ages, to silence the masses. It's going to get out of control. You can just see it coming. They think they have everything figured out, and it's going to work fine. No, it isn't. It just sucks because a lot of people are probably going to be snuffed out in the process. But that's going to finally be the clincher that's going to wake people up. As more and more people protest like that and refuse to back down, I thought those days were dying, but there are signs, there are still people like that out there. That's encouraging. Wish they got a little more aggressive about it. But then again, how can you today when they've got the firepower on their side, guys? They do. Even if every person in this country had a firearm, it's no match for beam weapons, for example. These pussies sit back in an office miles away and press a button today to deal with crowd control. Scum of the earth. But let them play their games, guys, because the more they do it, the more they're going to expose themselves for what they are. I hope I live to see the day. I don't want to see, you know, a lot of innocent people get killed, but I hope I live to see the day when these SOBs get their just deserts and the whole plan goes belly up. The whole damn thing comes unraveled. Oh, wouldn't that be frickin' glorious, man? I'd pay top dollar for front row seats to see that show. I wouldn't mind seeing bloodshed, guys. I get grossed out at the sight of blood, I'll tell you. I got a weak stomach for that. But if it's the blood of tyrants, monsters, I would love to see that. I would. I absolutely would gorge myself in it. Oh, yes. Yes. I would cheer it on. I'd jump in and participate. There needs to be a purging of this world, folks, if that's even the right word to use. Purging implies getting rid of a few bad apples. Oh, no, we need more than a purging. There's more than just a few bad apples. Anyway, here's some more updates on Pizzagate. Podesta was recently interviewed, and I couldn't tell from the video who it was that was interviewing, some mainstream media. The interview was very strange, too. Never seen anything like it. Those of you who have seen it, you know what I'm talking about. It has him seated in profile. He never looks at the camera. Well, I mean, that's not so strange in the sense that you can understand this little weaselly SOB not wanting people to see his facial expressions. First of all, to be able to more easily recognize him for those who are not familiar with him, number one. Number two, I think the main reason is he doesn't want people to see his eyes, to see his full facial expression, to be able to tell that he's lying through his rotten teeth every time he opens his friggin' mouth. Have you ever seen anybody interviewed, the entire interview with the person in profile? Have you guys seen this? You know what I'm talking about? It's the strangest freaking thing. The whole time, he never shows himself head on. It's always from the side. I find that very, very, very interesting. He probably said, oh, I'll agree to be interviewed as long as... Or maybe his handlers arranged it that way. Yeah, okay, why don't you do this interview? But you're going to tell him you have to be seen only in profile. Don't let people see your face because they're going to know you're lying.
Yeah, I'm not too good at this stuff.
Yeah, okay, we'll just do it all in profile. Here's the script so you know what to say. Or, you know, we'll have it up on the screen. Yeah, that's probably another reason, too. Maybe he's not used to reading off of a teleprompter, you know. So have me in profile so people can't see my eyes going back and forth as I read off the screen. Okay, yeah. Or the cue cards, you know. Very strange. But anyway, he's being interviewed. Oh, guys, I want to frickin' wrap my hands around his throat. Oh, yeah. You know what, Homeland Security? Up your arse. I could give a crap if you don't like me talking this way. Screw you. If you defend him, you need to have your little hind parts throttled, too. I just, I just hearing his voice, guys, looking at his sleazy face, I want to freaking pulverize him. Oh. When I think of that video when he's abusing that kid, oh, you little bastard. You son of a blankety blankety blank blank. Anyway, in the course of the interview, oh, and boy, does he actually mentions, you know, mainstream media. He mentions Alex Jones. He mentions InfoWars, you know. Again, not that Mr. Jones is the great bastion of truth, but, you know, he just uses him as a, because a lot more people now are familiar with him, so he uses him to represent, you know, alternative media. Hillary Clinton mentioned him by name, too, several months back in a speech to represent, you know, the crazies in the mainstream media. Yeah, whatever. The irony is, he's probably partied with all of them, you know. Naturally, they're going to mention him. Because even though he does mention Pizzagate and whatnot, he's still damage control, guys. He doesn't mention the top-notch players, our little tribal friends, you know. So if they're going to listen to alternative news, he's the one they want you to listen to. So they'll always mention him, you know. They're certainly not going to mention Renegade Broadcasting. But anyway, nevertheless, there he is blasting alternative media, and he's coming out the first time and mentioning Pizzagate, mentioning, you know, the pedophile ring and these phony claims. He doesn't address any of the charges that have been launched against him. He doesn't mention the emails. He doesn't attempt to debunk any of the very specific things. You know, him and his brother's taste in twisted pedophilic art. He doesn't mention their buddy Epstein. You know, on and on and on. None of this stuff. Doesn't mention any of it. Doesn't mention the emails and the references to Mr. Elefantis and the sleazy bands they have playing at the Comet Ping Pong that make reference to pedophilia in their songs and their videos. Nope. Doesn't mention any of that. Because he knows how damning it is. All he says is, the mainstream media has debunked all of that. But then he goes on to say, something technical has to be done to stop fake news, he said. Something technical has to be done. He called mainstream media, by the way, reality. That's reality, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, wow. I hope you got it straight now if you haven't before. Want reality? Turn in. Tune in to the mainstream media. Watch their real news. Oh, yeah. In the Twilight Zone now, baby. Thank heavens, folks. More and more people are catching on, though. They really are. As long as YouTube lasts, it's doing a lot to wake a lot of people up. Not just YouTube, the internet in general. Anyway, meanwhile, Lady Lynn Rothschild has begun distancing herself. In fact, she's been outright dissing Mr. Podesta. In a recent tweet, she called him a loser. Imagine that. Not mentioning, you know, Pizzagate or anything like that, of course, because she's freaking tied in with it. But, you know, this is what the tribe does, guys. Their own minions, they'll diss them. And this is an understanding they have from the word go. In your process of serving us, we might have to at some point trash your name. Don't worry, though. We'll take care of you. You won't go to jail, and we'll make sure that you're cushioned and your little hiney is pampered for the rest of your life. But you might have to take the fall for us, at least as far as getting bad publicity, you know. That's what's going on here. She can't have the public knowing about her connection with this guy. So she's dissing him, calling him a loser because of, you know, Hillary losing the election. She claims that she's pawning that off on him. But in doing that, she's trying to give the impression that I have no connection. So if anybody hears any connection I have with him, don't believe it. I'm calling him a loser, you see. She knows the Pizzagate thing is spiraling out of control. She's so afraid that it's going to lead to her front door. It already has, but I mean, not in critical mass. So she's engaging in damage control here, dissing him, calling him a loser. Well, she's absolutely right. He is, but so are you, you little wench. You're the chief loser. Anyway, another interesting item, a recently disclosed Podesta email, and I don't know when this email was written, but it was released recently anyway, and it has him stating that his lawyer, quote, kept me out of jail. Now, what do you suppose that means? Isn't that interesting? He said his lawyer, quote, kept me out of jail. My. Oh, guys, it just gets more and more. Like I said, man, be tuned into this. You're going to see more and more stuff come out. It's going to get worse and worse and worse. It's kind of entertaining in a way to watch these SOBs squirm. They're getting desperate, guys. They know the gig is up. That little SOB, guys, he can never walk the streets again with pride. He's probably going to request, I'm sure they've already promised him, Secret Service protection for the rest of his life. It used to be only that was given to presidents, and at that, it was only for, 5 years or 10 years after they left office, and then no more. Now they give protection to their frickin' kids and I believe there are congressmen now that get certain ones anyway that get Secret Service protection. So how much you want to bet he's got a security duty following him around and will for the rest of his life? But it doesn't matter, guys. Everywhere he goes now, he's going to have hecklers. He's going to have people yelling out, like when he was giving that interview on CNN. Yeah, you little bastard. But, guys, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. The truth is, that would bother people, normal people, to have hecklers. I don't think it bothers him at all. Well, I mean, he was cringing, but I think it was more out of anger that he wanted to call upon his thugs and have them brutalize those people or just plain shoot them, kill them. That's why he was cringing, not because he's ashamed or... No, they have no shame. None. And they don't care what people think. Only that it might ruin their careers or prevent them from getting speaking engagements at this or that or a university. That's all they care about. They don't give a damn. People recognize them as scum. They're proud of being scum. Nevertheless, though, guys, he's ruined as far as that goes. He's not going to get, I don't think Hillary's going to get the $250,000 that she was accustomed to for speaking engagements. As this thing snowballs and her connections are documented more and more thoroughly and people start catching on to that, she's finished. All of these scumbags are finished. Again, not that the law is going to go after them, no, but finished as far as, their reputation. It's gone. It's destroyed. I love it. But like I said, that's not enough, guys. That's not enough. These bastards need to hang by the freaking neck, man. Anyway. Get back to our discussion on Jesus' visit to India. Before I do that, though, I want to mention No, I'm not going to get around to it, at least not before my hiatus. But I put some notes together years ago on a group called the Thuggies that originated in India, or were endemic to India. They were a band of ruffians that, you know, would attack, for example, a caravan of you know, merchant traders going along the Silk Road, you know, steal everything and leave the people penniless, or maybe even kill them, in the, you know, whatever. Just ruthless thugs. And in that set of notes, I demonstrated, and if anybody wants, you know, just send me an email, I'll send you the notes. I demonstrated how these thuggies have Jew written all over them. I also talked about, you know, gypsies. Gypsies now are seen all over the world. You know, they're France, they're Italy, the United States, Canada, they're everywhere. But they actually originated in India. Gypsies, just like the tribe that spawned them, and they did spawn them. They did a show, I did a set of notes on them. If you want, you know, send me an email and I'll send you those notes as well. Gypsies definitely have tribal connections. What they were known for, like the thuggies, is ripping people off. Always have been. And, you know, not so much now. They've kind of redeemed themselves a little bit. But they've been known historically for ripping people off. Not like the thuggies with outright bullying and you know, killing if they had to. They were known for conniving people out of money. Sleazy, underhanded tactics, fooling them, lying to them, you know, tricking them, whatever, blah, blah, blah. My point is, both the thuggies and the gypsy originated in India. Lear, the tribe, had a strong presence going back to ancient times. And in those notes, I point out the tribal connection. So it's no wonder that Jesus would have gone to India, guys. Many prominent tribesmen had their fingers deep in the pie in India from very early on. All right, guys, short break, right back. All right, guys, welcome back. So anyway, we were talking yesterday about all these parallels between Jesus and Buddha. There's also a parallel in Buddhism with the trial of Christ found in a 2nd century B.C. Sanskrit play known as Mirkatika, or Little Clay Cart. It tells the story of how, after a meal, an innocent man known as Charudatta was accused of murdering the courtesan Vasantasena, and then is brought to trial. The judge, admitting his incompetence to condemn a Brahmin, sends the case over to the king, who condemns the man to be executed and impaled with an inscription on him. This sounds like the trial and execution of Christ, doesn't it? Orders him to be impaled, very similar to crucifixion, with an inscription on him, probably, you know, containing the charge that was being levied against him, which is what was done with Christ. A lot of Christians don't realize, you know, when the story is told, when the story is told of the soldiers nailing the placard on his cross that said Jesus, King of the Jews, they don't realize, you know, what that means. Why would the Romans have done that? Why did they nail Jesus, King of the Jews? Because that was his crime, ladies and gentlemen. That's the crime that he was being convicted of. They didn't nail him to the cross because,
well, the Jews wanted it that way, and we couldn't sway them, so we...
Get the hell out of here. They only crucified for the worst of crimes. And at the top of that list was treason. In fact, that's really the only reason the two thieves on his either side, the malefactors. If you read the text, guys, right in the Gospels, it tells you they were insurrectionists. That's not why they were executed, because they were thieves. They didn't kill and crucify people because they were thieves. They happened to have been thieves, yes, but they were also insurrectionists. That's why they were being executed or crucified. Crucifixion was reserved only for the most vile criminals. So the fact that, and they often, like I said, placed a notice on the cross of the crucifixion victims, indicating what their crime was that they were being crucified for. So there you go. Jesus, King of the Jews. They were executing him for treason, for claiming to be king. Anyway, Charudatta, in this story or this play, is then ordered to carry his cross, or sulam in the Sanskrit, cross, or more likely a pole that he was impaled on. But it talks about he carried it. Yeah, you know, Jesus is said to have carried his cross for a little ways anyway. He's said to have carried it to the place of execution. In the meantime, the king's brother-in-law, who actually murdered the courtesan, buries the body under a pile of leaves, but then found by a Buddhist monk who raises the victim from her deadly swoon. Vasantasena then saves Charudatta from death. So, you know, it looks like a resurrection. Raised from the dead. So you even got that going on in this play. The whole storyline of Christ's execution. Condemned, made to carry the cross, later raised from the dead, you know, on and on. Afterwards, we're told that Charudatta forgave the accuser, Samsanaka, and appointed the Buddhist monk as the head of all the Buddhist monasteries in the realm. There's a marriage in the end as well. Charudatta accepts Vasantasena, whatever, as his second wife, whatever. But yet you understand that the idea of forgiveness, the very one that condemned him to death now was forgiven. Isn't that interesting? Same idea with Jesus. Forgive your enemies, you know, blah, 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 blah. But look at the parallels here with the story of basically a crucifixion and then a resurrection thereafter. You gotta love it, man. Another Buddhist play, this one from the 2nd to 1st century BC, known as Sangabhadivastu, parallels the tale of Christ's crucifixion as well. In this story, Gautama, a holy man, is wrongfully condemned to die on the cross or on a stake for murdering the courtesan Bhadra. Gautama is impaled on a cross or a stake, whatever, and his mentor, Krishna Dvapayana, visits him and enters into a long dialogue, at the end of which Gautama dies at the place of skulls. The place of skulls. Golgotha Hill, where Christ was crucified, is called, is known as the place of skulls, or the hill of skulls. Isn't that interesting, guys? Anyway. There's many other things that Christ said and did. It would have originated in India. For example, his saying, the kingdom of heaven is within you. Buddha, of course, talked along those same lines. His alleged ability to raise the dead was known as Ishitvam in India. And his professed power to walk on the water, which I think I mentioned yesterday, Buddha is said to have done the same thing, or levitate, was known as Vayu Siddhi in India. Nothing unique about anything Christ said, anything he did, his whole life story, his miracles, all of it, guys, all of it was nothing but a repeat of things that were already played out long before he came around. Not only his teachings, guys, but very often things that he said, or at least things that were attributed to him having said, are verbatim quotes. Remember that one example I gave where, you know, in Matthew 23, he's crying over Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I desire to take you under my wings like a mother hen, you know, blah, 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 blah. But you would have no part of me. Behold, your house is left under you desolate. That's a quote from the book of 2 Esdras, crying out loud. An apocryphal book, that. A book that was rejected, left out of the canon, and yet Jesus quotes verbatim from it. Verbatim. Anyway, all of these parallelisms that we looked at yesterday, today, there's far too many of them. And they're far too detailed to be ignored or dismissed out of hand. Thus, we have a very strong case here for Christ having spent at least a good part of those 15 or so missing interim years of his life, from the age of 12, 27, or whatever, late 20s or about the age of 30, in India, and most likely having studied Buddhism while there. It makes sense, right? They wanted him to be thoroughly trained, thoroughly versed in all the great philosophies of the day, so that he could maximize his influence on his audience. Take the best from all the world's great religions. I did a show once where I showed comparisons between Christ and Confucius, Christ and, you know, ancient Chinese wisdom. Yeah, of course. He studied them all, guys. He had a long time to do it, too, didn't he? He traveled abroad, which is why the Gospels are so silent about those missing years. They don't want you to know what the hell he was doing. That he wasn't being taught. My God! Yeah, whatever. He was taking it all in. And then, when he returns to the not-so-holy land, we see him spewing those very teachings that he learned in his travels. So obvious, man. But, oh, boy, guys, the excuses that you get, it's so freaking sad. I was on the phone last night with a friend of mine. I've mentioned him before. Nice guy, really is. But I don't think he's ever, ever going to come out of his coma, man. It's so freaking frustrating. It's amazing, guys. It's just absolutely amazing. Once somebody is hooked by something like this, hey, I'll say this. At least he admitted to me, you know, I know what you're saying. I don't have an answer. And I've looked into it, some of these things you're talking about in the past, and even some of the greatest theologians out there have admitted they don't have answers. And so I was trying to tell him, buddy, I think I do have the answer. You can't trust this book, this God, this religion. No, he just won't go there. He won't do it. While yet acknowledging that these problems do exist. It's amazing. Most Bible dupes won't even acknowledge that. There's no problems, blah, 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 and they'll just walk away. Like Podesta, you know. The mainstream media already debunked that. Oh, really? Well, give us some specific examples. How did they debunk this, that, this, that, this, that? He won't do that, of course. He just makes a blanket statement. They already debunked it. It's all straightened out. Bible dupes do the same thing. Most of them, you know. Most of them won't do what this guy, this friend of mine, did last night. They won't admit that there's problems. They'll just say, oh, yeah, that stuff's already been addressed. There's any number of Christian apologetics books out there that destroy those arguments. And they'll walk away thinking that they won the argument and you've got nothing to hang a hook on. And, holy Jesus H. Sorry, Bible dupes. But it's you that don't have a hook to hang anything on. You have no footing. You have no standing. When you have mounds and mounds and mounds and mounds and mounds and endless mounds of evidence presented to you, and the best you can come up with is,
that's already been refuted.
Just a blanket statement, not actually addressing it. I remember when my inquisition took place, you know, over the Trinity thing, and this one guy was heckling me. I asked him, have you actually even read my book?
I don't need to read that.
You haven't even read it and you're condemning me?
I don't need to read that at that watchtower thing.
You haven't even read it and you're denouncing me and my findings. People like that, guys, when they open their mouths, I don't hear a human being speaking coherent words. All I hear is, these people are asses with a capital A. To this day, that mindless drone still shows up every week at his steepled corporation and absorbs whatever comes from that pulpit mindlessly and will do so till his dying day. You know what amazes me is, he was an Adventist, is an Adventist. Adventists are known for their rejection of Roman Catholic teachings, you know, calling the papacy the Antichrist. As I pointed out before, they do meet all the identifying marks of the biblical little horn power, the Antichrist. But nevertheless, what a bunch of hypocritical SOBs to condemn the Catholic Church for its authoritarianism, its demands to adhere to its dogmas without question. And, you know, they talk about their frustration with a lot of Catholics. You try to show them that, look, your church is teaching stuff that isn't in the Bible. Look, you can clearly see the Bible condemns worshiping statues of Mary, for example. You know, it doesn't matter. It just goes right over them. But yet, there I was in the Adventist church trying to show them, look, this Trinity doctrine, man, it's not in the Bible. In fact, the Roman Catholic Church invented it. They're the ones that gave it the official kickoff, you know, that gave it their blessing. It wouldn't exist except for them. They even boast about it in their own literature. It's not in the Bible. In fact, it's totally antithetical to what the Bible teaches. And what did I get? Same thing. Same thing that they say they're frustrated with Catholics for, that when you show them stuff in the Bible, they just won't listen. I got the same thing. The hypocrisy of the whole damn mess, guys. Man, is it disgusting. Like I said, guys, you know, there's a few exceptions, but for the most part, I not only have no respect for most Christians, I actually can't stand them. Can't stand them, for the most part. Can't stand them. There's a few decent ones out there that, like I said, like this friend of mine, he'll go to his grave. He'll never change. He'll never give it up. He just has too much riding on it. And quite frankly, probably couldn't handle life without his crutch to lean on. It's pretty sad. It is. But I still respect him because he is a decent person, you know. He's not a cutthroat. He doesn't condemn my soul to hell because I don't see eye to eye with him, but, you know. But that's rare, guys. That's very rare. Most of them are absolutely hateful. Hateful. Anyway, getting back to my notes here. Some might object that if Christ did study Buddhism, could just as easily have traveled to China instead of India and done the same thing. So these parallels between Buddha and Christ don't necessarily imply an India connection. And that's true. Like I said, there's a lot of parallels with Confucius. My argument is he did both. In fact, he pretty much got to travel through India to get to China anyway, if you do so by land. But, you know, this evidence doesn't necessarily imply an India connection. He could have simply got Buddhism from China. However, though, there are, you know, numerous ancient Buddhist documents that contain biographical references to one called Issa, I-S-S-A, which is the Quranic name for Jesus, the Middle Eastern name for Jesus. We talked about that yesterday. And state that Issa went to India at age 13 to study the ways of Buddha. There you go. Anyway. So, like I said, there's evidence he did, in fact, probably go to China as well. But clearly, you've got ancient Sanskrit documents that talk about Isa, i.e. Jesus, studying Buddhism right there in India. And we're going to look at a lot more undeniable connections with India, of the presence of Christ there. Notice, though, it says he went at age 13. Yeah, because they know that he disappeared after his little stint there at the temple, you know, debating theology with the Pharisees at age 12. Keep in mind, too, I've mentioned this before, that it was standard practice for the Essenes to intensively train young children to be intimately familiar with the Torah, as well as with unique Essene teachings as well. And then at age 12, they would send them out to debate theology with the learned theologians of the day. After that, they would come back to complete their training now, turn them into masters. Their real intensive training would begin now at that age. And they wouldn't emerge as full Jedi masters until about the age 30. Jesus' life followed that pattern. But it's obvious that he didn't spend all of his time in the Qumran community. In fact, probably as part of his training, they required him to go to places like India and England, and, you know. In addition to his Qumran training, he obviously went to some of the prestigious educational establishments up in Britain with Uncle Joe. Anyway, let's look at some evidence of Christ in India later on in his adult life, after the
alleged crucifixion.
Some researchers believe that Christ never died on the cross, as I said. Either that he somehow survived the ordeal, or that he never even went to Calvary to begin with. Don't forget, you know, the Gospels state that most of the people, except for the few that stood at the foot of his cross, but most of the onlookers stood afar off, it says. They were at a great distance. They couldn't get a close-up view of him, so that they really couldn't identify whether that was him or not. The few that were at the foot of the cross were probably just there for window dressing purposes. They were in on the gag. Probably wasn't even him on the cross. If it was, like I said, guys, they probably just arranged it. Whatever was in that sponge that they offered him probably was, you know, just designed to knock him out so the soldiers would think he's already dead, take him off the cross, put him in the tomb, and then Joseph came along. Hey, can I, here's a few bucks. Can I, I take his body? Yeah, okay, sure. You're one of his relatives anyway. Why not? And he wasn't even dead. Nursed him back to health, you know, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, one thing seems certain, that Christ, after the time of his alleged crucifixion, journeyed back to India, and that he may have, at this time, been exposed to Hinduism. There's even evidence that he may have visited, as I mentioned earlier this week, you know, Scotland, but that's another story. We can find ourselves, of course, here with India. He appears to have lived out a good deal of the rest of his life in India, according to some of these legends. But, of course, the same claims are made about Scotland. As the caller said yesterday, you know, there's evidence that Jesus actually died, or at least Mary died his mother or whatever died in India. Even supposed to be a tomb there. And so, you know, people, Christians, will poo-poo these stories away because they'll say, are you kidding? All of these countries, France said it, Scotland, England, India, Egypt even has a claim that he went there and may have died there. Point is, he traveled to these various places, no question about it. It's only natural, though, that local legends would arise. They would want to say that their soil is blessed with the bones of, you know, the great Jesus. Who knows where he died? As I said, there's been two tombs found in Jerusalem that, you know, appear to have been the tomb of Christ. Both of them. We talked about that, what was it, last week. Probably neither one really are the tombs of Jesus. Probably the one in India isn't his tomb either. Who knows? Who knows? There's any number of ways of explaining that. People just, you know, wanted it to be that way. They just made this story up and later carved in the name Esau or Jesus or whatever. Or it could be that somebody who, you know, was given that name or assigned himself that name went there and you know, was mimicking Jesus and, you know, some cult follower wanted to be like his hero. So we went to this other land. Who knows, guys? There's any number of explanations. But it's interesting to take a look at all of them because any one of them has the potential to, you know, to either be true or at least to have some important elements of truth. The thing I'm trying to draw attention to here is just the fact that he did do a lot of traveling. He obviously went to India. As to whether or not the tomb ascribed to him is really is, doesn't matter. It's just very interesting that you do see all of these connections. All you got to do, though, is just look at his teachings. Look at the parallels with Buddha, with Confucius. Obviously, guys, he was influenced by them. Even if you want to say he didn't travel, hey, doesn't matter. He had access to Buddhist writings, didn't he? And he copied them. Bible dupes, of course, I love this, man. they'll say that the copying because of the rest, that it was these pagans that were copying Jesus. When they pre-existed him by hundreds of thousands of years? All right, guys. When we talk about connections between Christ and India, too, another thing we've got to keep in mind is the idea of, you know, the so-called 10 lost tribes. There was a dispersal after the Babylonian captivity. And it appears that these 10 tribes, or at least perhaps a good many of them, wound up settling in India. And don't forget that an important part of Christ's mission was to seek out these lost, dispersed tribes. I mentioned how he went to Gadaria in Spain to recruit some from the tribe of Gad that had settled there. He said, "I am come only for the lost sheep or the lost tribes of the house of Israel." He wanted to gather them together. He needed numbers, right? He wanted to bring them back so they could assist in the uprising he was planning. He told his disciples to go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He said he came for them, and he wanted his disciples to go looking for them. "Go not into the way of the Gentiles," he told them. Jewish Encyclopedia states under, quote, tribes, the heading tribes, Abraham Farisol identifies the river Ganges with the river Goksan and assumes that the Beni Israel of India are the descendants of the lost 10 tribes. Isn't that interesting? A Christian traveler, Vincent of Milan, was a prisoner in the hands of the Turks for 25 years and went as far as Fez, thence to India, where he found the river Sembatyam and a number of Jews dressed in silk and purple. So they acknowledged that there have been a great many Jews that have settled there since ancient times. Yeah. Since Christ was so obsessed with recruiting these lost tribes, and since we know that there was a major settlement there from ancient times, don't you think he would have wanted to go there? Of course. Don't you think he did go there? Yeah. In the process of going there to try to recruit some of these lost tribesmen, he studied their native religious teachings. In fact, while there, they probably told him, "Hey, Jesus, you might want to look into some of these great wise teachings. Look at this guy, Buddha. Have you heard of him? Look what he taught. You should familiarize yourself with this." "Oh, thanks. I'll take some of his books with me." "This will supplement my education I've been getting from the Essenes and from those great schools over in Britain." There's apparently no question that Jesus... the Jews had a presence in India since pre-Christian times, and that Jesus was trying to reconnect with them. Furthermore, according to their ancient traditions, the Afghans are also to be identified, the lost tribes of Israel, or at least have a history interconnected with them. They declare that Nebuchadnezzar banished them into the mountains of Gor, whence they maintained correspondence with the Arabian Jew. There you go. Afghani tradition talks about how Nebuchadnezzar banished many Jews to their region. Yeah. Don't doubt that at all. To this day, many Afghans consider themselves Beni Israel, Arabic for children of Israel. We also have several historical references to Christ having gone to India later in life. Saint Jerome, for example, who lived from 342 to 420 AD, wrote, quote, "He," meaning Christ, "dwelt in all places with Thomas in India, for example," he said. There you have Jerome, early Christian writer, talking about Jesus having gone to India. See, these early Christian writers, guys, they knew about the very things we're talking about here. They knew about these close correlations with Jesus' teachings. And having lived closer to his time, there were surely a lot more traditions floating around, many of which have been lost to us. There was sure a lot more documentation available to him than what we have to show. Or should I say, documentation that probably isn't altogether lost, but has been suppressed and continues to be suppressed from us. Oh, guys, I can guarantee you there's a hell of a lot more information that still is extant, that's still out there, that we'll probably never have access to. I guarantee you guys, one place that has it is the Vatican, no question about it. If the masses ever do wake up and rise up to overthrow this entire monstrosity of a system, I hope it will include raiding the archives of that corrupt institution. Oh, the secrets that will be revealed on that day. I guarantee you it is going to be shocking. Anyway, in the apocryphal Acts of Thomas and the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus is described as having met with Thomas on numerous occasions after his crucifixion, instructing him specifically to evangelize in India. Also in the Acts of Thomas, Thomas says that he and Christ attended the court of King Gundafor of Taxila, now known as Pakistan, in about 47 AD, and that eventually both the king and his brother accepted Christ's teachings. Well, if there's any truth to that, that wouldn't be a very hard thing to do, would it? Because his teachings so paralleled those of Buddha anyway. And there was probably a lot of tribal blood there to begin with. And they just saw him as a fellow tribesman, you know. Anyway, Kashmiri historical document states that Isa, again, the Quranic name for Christ, was also known as Yuz Asaf, or leader of the healed. He's known as a healer. There are two plains in eastern Afghanistan near Ghazni and Jalalabad that bear the name of Yuz Asaf. That's interesting. It's like we have so many ancient place names in Britain and in Scotland and whatnot that talk of a clearly hinted a presence of Jesus there in ancient times. So you have an Indian guy. It turns out that there are more than 21 historical documents that bear witness to the existence of Jesus in Kashmir, where he was known both as Yuz Asaf and Isa. Numerous references. 21 documents, guys. Probably a lot more than that at one time. There may yet be more still extant that will never see the light of day. Just like the Mahabharata, guys. 90% of the Mahabharata has never been translated and never released to the public. Only 10%. That small 10% is absolutely amazing, isn't it? The stuff that's in there. References to all kinds of advanced high-tech inventions in the ancient world, for example. What's in the other 90%? Like I said, guys, that's what they were studying in the Manhattan Project. One specific example of these ancient documents making reference to Christ is the Bhavishyat Mahapurana, volume 9, verses 17 to 32, which contains an account of Isa Masi, or Jesus the Messiah. I mean, come on, man. This is unbelievable. It describes Christ's arrival in the Kashmir region of India and his encounter with King Shalabhana, who ruled the Kushan area from 39 to 50 AD, and who entertained Christ as a guest for some time, this ruler. Christians might say, oh, these are just phony traditions. You know, maybe some early Christians visited there, or, you know, some might even admit that maybe earlier in his life, Jesus might have gone there, but not later in his life, after the time, or later, after the time of the crucifixion. Why would they make up traditions like this, specifically that Jesus was there if it didn't happen? Some of this undoubtedly got flavored with hyperbole, but these traditions go back to the early centuries, guys, very early. Why would they make stuff up like this in the early centuries when Christianity wasn't even popular there at the time? It was predominantly, as is the case today, either Buddhist or Hindu, right? Christianity has grown to a large extent there now in more modern centuries. But back then, no. So why would they boast that Jesus was there? Why would they have a tradition going back to the early centuries? Who would give a damn? Who would care, right? Anyway, the historian Mulla Nadini in 1413 also recounted a story of Yuz Asaf, who was a contemporary of King Gopadatta, and confirmed that he also used the name Isar, i.e. Isa, or Jesus. Oh, we have a tradition going back to the early 15th century of these visits of Jesus to India. All down to the centuries, these traditions have circulated. There's also much historical evidence in the towns and villages of northern India to prove that Jesus and his mother Mary spent time in the area. He was all over the place in India. Took the grand tour, if you will. At the border of a small town called Mari, for example, there's a nearby mountain called Pindi Point, upon which is an old tomb called Mai Mari Da Ashan, or the final resting place of Mary. That's interesting. This is the tomb that the caller yesterday was referring to. The tomb is said to be very old, and local Muslims venerate it as the grave of Isa's mother, or Jesus' mother. The tomb itself is oriented east-west, consistent with the Jewish tradition, despite the fact that it is within a Muslim area. Assuming its antiquity, such a tomb could not be Hindu either, since the Hindus, contemporary to Christ, cremated their dead and scattered their ashes as do Hindus today. They didn't have proper burials, and they wouldn't have lined the tomb east-west. Following Christ's trail into Kashmir between the villages of Nagam and Nilmij, there was a meadow called Yuz Marj, or the meadow of Yuz Asaf, i.e. Jesus. Look at all these ancient place names connected with Christ. Then there's the sacred building called Aish Mukam, just southeast of Sringar near Bij Bihara. Just way too many examples of stuff like this. Aish, by the way, is derived from Isa. And Mukham means place of rest or repose. Hence, Aish Mukham means Jesus's place of rest. Very interesting. Another piece of evidence. Within the Aish Mukham is a sacred relic called the Moses Rod, or the Jesus Rod, which local legend says belonged to Moses himself. Again, as to whether it's true or not, probably not, but it doesn't matter, guys. The point here is that there are so many ancient traditions, so many ancient artifacts, so many ancient place names that connect India, not only since Christian times, but even since before the time of Christ, with the tribe. They established a very strong and early presence there, didn't they? Christ is said to also have held this rod. That's why it's sometimes called the rod of Christ. Perhaps to confirm his Mosaic heritage, because it kind of represents like a royal scepter, you know. He was the one found worthy to hold this royal scepter that was attributed to Moses. Whatever, man. Above the town of Sringar. Oh, and by the way, we do know, of course, that Jesus was very much into the idea of a lineage going back to Moses, wasn't he? Didn't he tell his leaders not to do the things the Pharisees did, but to follow what they said because they sit in Moses' seat? Of course he did. Right there in Matthew 23. You got to love that, guys. Moses, the tyrannical, land-stealing, money-grubbing, bloodthirsty tyrant. Jesus had nothing but good to say about him. And he said that the Pharisees, whom he so often rejected and denounced, yet he told his leaders to follow the teachings of these very individuals that he had nothing good to say about. You gotta love it. Because why?
Well, they sit in Moses' seat.
You gotta be kidding me. That right there should tell you that this guy is a monkey. Well, it looks like I dropped. Yeah. Renegade is offline. Okay, I think we're back.
Wow. Yeah, it's all been recorded. The stream just dropped for a short bit. So
No problem, man. Thanks. Yeah, every once in a while, get those little glitches going on, but thankfully it wasn't for too long. Anyway, this time I happened to hear the noise. I thought somebody was calling in. Sometimes I don't hear it. Anyway, above the town of Sringar or Srinagar is a temple known as the Throne of Solomon, which dates back to at least 1000 B.C., which King Gopadatta had restored at about the same time as Christ's advent. So there's a connection with Solomon. The restoration was done by a Persian architect who personally left four inscriptions on the side steps of the temple. The third and fourth inscriptions read as follows. At this time, Yuz Asaph, or Jesus, announced his prophetic calling in year 50 and 4, and he is Jesus, prophet of the sons of Israel. Imagine that. You can't write all this stuff off, guys. There's got to be something to this. Once again, Christians dismiss it out of hand, for the most part, anyway. They dismiss this out of hand. No, that's not possible. If it's not in the Bible, dot, dot, dot.
if it's not in the Bible. More like, if it is in the Bible, not to be trusted. But they want you to think, if it's not in the Bible, it's not to be trusted. Oh, whatever, man. Oh, yeah, that book is so trustworthy, isn't it? It literally is not one page of the thing that you can turn that you don't find major, major problems, numerous problems, literally on every single page. My upcoming book, guys, roughly 500 pages, it doesn't contain all the problems, only the biggest, the most major one. If I was to list every last single, oh my God, forget it. The book would be bigger than the Bible itself to elaborate on all of the problems. But it does contain all the biggest ones that I've found over the years. I'm sure there's a lot more big ones I haven't even discovered yet. But in any case, when you have a book 500 pages in length, and each page is loaded with one after another, contradiction after endless contradiction. You got some serious problems there now, don't you? And yet, you know, Bible dupes will dismiss that thing out of hand. They won't even, most of the time, you give them something like that, they won't even look at it. Pretty sad. A book of that size, doesn't that tell you something? There must be something wrong here. There must be a lot of things wrong. If you can write a book of that length exposing problems, you think it would get them to question, gee, suppose maybe I've been wrong. Maybe I've been lied to about so many other things. So many other people in high positions have been lying to us about so many things. Maybe people in high positions in the religious world have been lying too, and lying for a very long time. I really should look into this. Big mystery to me. I don't understand it, why people wouldn't want to pursue something like that. Don't you want to know for sure that what you've been believing is the truth? Don't you want to know for sure by looking at what the strongest arguments that could ever be raised are saying against your book? So that you can be all the more sure. If you ignore it, that tends to tell me you already suspect there's something wrong and just don't want to hear it. Thus, your claim to want the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth is very hollow, isn't it? Really sad, guys. That's all too common kind of response. And expect that will be the kind of response you'll get when you share this book, you know, with believers. Anytime you talk to believers about their faith and the problems with it, that's what you're going to get. Pretty sad. Anyway, moving on here. Christ is said to have died in Kashmir at about the age of 80. His tomb, says one scholar, lies in Srinagar's old town in a building called Rosabal. Or Rosabal. Rosabal is an abbreviation of Raza Baal, meaning tomb of a prophet. At the entrance, there's an inscription explaining that Yus Asaf, or Jesus, is buried there, along with another Muslim saint. Oh, jeez. Both have gravestones. Apparently, it was supposed to believe that this Muslim saint was interred there, you know, centuries later. Anyway, both have gravestones which are oriented in a north-south direction, according to Muslim tradition. So, you know, out the window goes that being an authentic first-century Jewish burial, which would have more than likely been oriented east-west, unless they moved it. If you want to argue that it was Jesus' burial was real. Anyway, through a small opening, the true burial chamber can be seen, in which
there is the sarcophagus of Yuz Asaf in East West. Oh, well, there you go. There you go. That's interesting. So the Jesus casket, or the Yuz Asaf, is actually interred East West. The structure built above it is North South. But the actual tomb, yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, it doesn't mean it's Jesus, but it does mean it is a Jewish burial from probably the first century. As to whose remains there is anyone's guess, but it was a tribal burial. That's interesting. According to Professor Hasnayan, who has studied this tomb, there are carved footprints on the gravestones, and when closely examined, carved images of a crucifix and a rosary can be seen. Well, there's your Catholic influence right there, so this doesn't, the rosary part doesn't go back to the first century, but well, you know, quite old, probably carved by a later devotee of Catholic faith. There we go. Another short break, right back. All right, guys, welcome back. So anyway, we're talking about these carved footprints. The engraved footprints of Yuz Asaf, or Jesus, have what appears to be scars represented on both feet. That's interesting, because you know, crucifixion wasn't practiced in ancient India. So clearly, this carving is of Christian origin, someone who was intimately familiar with the story of Jesus. And even if you want to argue that it was just Christian missionaries that went there, they went there very early on, didn't they? My argument would be they were just following an already well-established connection that Jesus had established. Anyway, this tomb is referred to by some as Hazrat Isa Sahib, or Tomb of the Lord Master Jesus. Ancient records acknowledge the existence of this tomb as long ago as 112 AD. Records that make reference to this tomb as early as 112. That's very interesting, isn't it? It does indeed go back to the earliest periods of Christian history. The Grand Mufti, a prominent Muslim cleric, has confirmed that Hazrat Isa Sahib is indeed the tomb of Yuz Asaf, or Jesus. Interestingly, after the fake 9/11 terrorist attacks, in the wake of the breakout of war in the region, the tomb of Isa was largely looted. Oh, doesn't that figure? Many of the artifacts were removed, and modern alterations to the structure were made. Pretty sad, isn't it? And yet to be expected. You know, we saw the same thing, guys, once war broke out in Iraq. They do. They looted the Baghdad Museum, and they totally disrupted the ruins of ancient Babylon. Aside from the worst tragedy of all, you know, the loss of human life, there's also that, guys. So disgusting. Remember in the first Gulf War, to demonize Saddam, you know, amongst other things, remember they lit, you know, several oil wells on fire, and then they said that Saddam did it. But another thing they did is they claimed that, you know, look at these Iraqis, they have no scruples. In order to hide from U.S. Attack, you know, they've been sneaking in amongst the ruins of ancient Babylon, knowing that we wouldn't want to bomb them. But, you know, that's probably all BS, right? But during the second Iraq war, U.S. troops were hiding in among the Baghdad, the Babylonian ruin. They were the ones doing what they claimed the Iraqis were doing, years earlier. Oh, man. The damage done, guys, it's irreparable. It's they dismantled some of the buildings, bulldozed the area, freaking unbelievable. But anyway, just like they looted ancient treasures in Iraq during the Iraq War, they also looted treasures when they went into, Afghanistan, Pakistan, in the wake of 9/11. Anyway, that concludes our discussion on India. Got another half hour or so left here, so we'll begin our next and final installment of this series. We talked about, Christ connections in England and Scotland, India. Now let's look at Egypt. Kind of touched on this already somewhat in the past, but we'll go into it here now in some more detail. According to the book of Matthew, after Jesus was born, King Herod saw him as a threat, to his power. Since he was allegedly told by the Magi that Jesus was to become ruler in Israel. Thus, as the story goes, and it's just that, a story, he gave orders to slaughter all babies in Bethlehem and the surrounding region, 2 years and under. Kill them all. Yeah, sure he did. But in any case, as a result of this, we're told, Joseph was allegedly told by an angel, to pack his bags and get out and head for Egypt, to go into hiding for a while until Herod was dead and his rampage would be over. You find this in Matthew 2:13-15, which says, "An angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said. Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. So clearly, Jesus did go to Egypt as an infant. And we don't even know how long of a time that was supposed to have been. Herod, I think, died in 6 BC or something. You got to love that, too. Because according to Matthew, yes, Jesus was born during the reign of Herod. But if you look at Luke's gospel, he was born, over 10 years later. During the time of Quirinius. Quirinius was not in power until 10 years after Herod died. Bible dupes, yeah. Your book is so authentic and reliable. It is the truth, and there's no errors in it. It's infallible. But anyway, according to Matthew's account, Jesus fled to Egypt to escape from Herod. So if you go by that account, and indeed, as a Bible dupe, you have to go by the account that he went to Egypt at least as a baby and must have spent several years there. So Jesus had connections in Egypt. So it's not too much of a stretch, is it, to imagine that he would return there later in life. Some old friends, contacts that were made by his parents, probably made multiple journeys there back and forth. Mentioned how there was a secret society there known as the Therapeutae that were intimately connected with the Essenes. They appear to have been an offshoot. Well, scenes might have been an offshoot of Deborah Touche instead of the other way around. It's hard to tell, but they were there for quite some time, centuries before Christ. The Essenes also existed, you know, one or two centuries before the time of Christ, so it's hard to know which came first, the chicken or the egg, but nevertheless, that's most likely who Joseph and Mary stayed with when they went to Egypt. Some of their connections over there with the Therapeutia. Anyway, the gospel record would have us believe that the Holy Family returned to Palestine after Herod died and settled in, quote, Nazareth. Again, guys, there's no such place in the first century. There was no such town. But it doesn't matter. We're told that they came back to the Holy Land after the death of Herod. But, you know, we got to wonder, did Jesus come back at all after the death of Herod? Or did he only return at the age of 12 when we're told that he was debating theology in the temple? Maybe he was gone his entire childhood. Where was he all that time? He certainly disappeared. Don't forget, I mentioned all those passages where he, you know, people didn't recognize him. Who is this guy? Oh, I think he's the son of Joseph. He wasn't known. He had been away for a long time. Not only during his childhood, but his early adult life. Later, you know, when he began his ministry, people didn't know who he was. Again, since we know he went to Egypt as a baby, we can safely assume that he must have spent a considerable amount of time there and probably returned there. But what did he do while he was there? Well, we know that Jesus clearly was Essene-trained, though he later parted ways with the Essenes. He clearly was initially trained by them from the time that he was very young. But where did the Essenes train him? It's possible he went to the Qumran sect, but he might, in fact, have received his training by the Essenes or the Therapeutic branch in Egypt. Anyway, the exact part of Egypt that Jesus appears to have been taken as a child was Cetus, where a Kabbalistic sect of the Essenes had set up camp, known as, again, the Therapeutae, which taught a Kabbalistic mystical type of healing that focused on meditation and the use of certain sounds and verbs that allegedly released a powerful healing energy when spoken. Now, this is all very interesting because remember I did the show on the Egyptian magical texts and how Jesus later quoted verbatim from them numerous times, guys. Many famous statements that Christ made in his various sermons that he gave publicly were lifted right out of ancient Egyptian magical texts. So we can clearly, safely conclude that while in Egypt, he must have been studying many of these ancient magical texts, which the Therapeutae were making use of. They blended Judaism with local Egyptian magical, you know, practices. Maybe they even introduced these magical practices to the Egyptians. In any case, these magical practices were indulged in by the Therapeutae. That's really what their name means, therapeutic. They were healers, so-called, using magic. Isn't that interesting? How many times have we seen that before? The tribe claiming to have healing powers using magic. Suckered many kings in with their little hocus-pocus tricks. Oh, yes, 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 yes. Nostradamus was one of them. That's what got his foot in the door of the royal court so he could weave his little web. They got a long history of doing that, baby. Long history. But this becomes all the more interesting when we realize that, you know, Jesus' miracle of turning water into wine, for example, was nothing but a stolen magic trick from Herod of Alexandria over in Egypt. This is when Jesus was exposed to writers like that, to magicians like that. He learned about this magic trick, guys, and he used it at the Cana wedding to wow his audience. I love it. When you read the account of that miracle, nobody saw the water magically turn to wine before their eyes. To perform this miracle, he instructed water to be poured into these jugs, and then wine came forth from the spout. Oh, it can't get more transparent than that. Now we see that he did, in fact, train in Egypt. Come on, damn it. The Therapeutae employed magic tricks to do their healing miracles. Jesus was called a magician in early manuscripts, ladies and gentlemen. Jesus the magician. It was just a papyrus fragment found a few years ago. Very small fragment that reads, Jesus the magician. Some apocryphal books make reference to Jesus being a practitioner of magic. Where did he learn it? He learned it in Egypt from the Therapeutae. Remember how I said when Jesus sent his disciples out on their first missionary journey, he told them how there were various houses that they would be able to go to that would take them in. Greet them as the sons of peace, one of the titles that the frickin' Essenes were known by, right? What other houses could he have been talking about that would take them in? There were no Christian houses yet. The Christian religion didn't exist yet. But the Essene religion did. At this time, Jesus still had close connections maintained with the Essenes, or at least some of them. Later, he broke away from them, and the distinction line became more and more, more obvious as time went on. He separated himself more from them, you know, became more radical, more extreme. But early on in his ministry, he still had those close ties. And so he's telling his disciples, yeah, you got these houses that will take you in. So it was when Joseph and Mary went to Egypt. They didn't just pick up their things and take off to this foreign country, not knowing where the hell they're going and how they're going to survive. They already had, through their little network, they already had connections established. So that when they got there, boom, there was a place for them to stay. Uncle Joe financed the whole thing. You couldn't just up and leave. They were supposed to be poor. How could they have afforded a journey? What did they eat traveling across a desert, guys? Think about it. My God, man, how gullible people are. Who's supposed to believe that, Joseph threw Jesus on his back in his little knapsack piggyback thing and grabbed his wife's hand. Okay, let's journey across the desert for a week or two without food or water. God will provide. Okay, Bible believers, why don't you try that? Fly out today to Judea and pray to the Lord that he'll provide for you while you go on foot to Egypt. See how long you last. Freaking ridiculous. But anyway, obviously, guys, they had assistance from Uncle Joe. His little trading caravan took them across to Egypt and arranged for them to have a place to stay while there. Probably several years. And while there, Jesus received his early training. I'll argue he wasn't just there for a few years. He's probably there up until he's 12 years old. The time that we're told he shows up, they appear to have gone there for, for a feast or something. and then he goes to the temple to debate theology with the scribes, the Pharisees. That's probably the first time he showed up there since he was born. All during those previous years, he probably spent most of his time in Egypt, learning from the Essene sect, the Therapeutae, learning his little magic tricks. Anyway, we know about this sect, the Therapeutae, from the writings of the tribe member Philo of Alexandria. He wrote about them in his work on the contemplative life. Therein, he reveals the Therapeutae were spread abroad, but concentrated mainly in Cetus near Alexandria. Very, very interesting. He also said that they were dedicated to prayer and study, and that their focus was curing the soul from lusts, pain, and fear, as well as attaining the higher life. Their main staple food was bread, and the sermons or discourses delivered by their leaders were based on allegory, i.e. parable, ladies and gentlemen. Parable. Their main staple was bread, so was that the case with the Essenes? The Essenes, guys, ate daily meals consisting of bread and wine. Bread and wine. Isn't that interesting? Where did Jesus get his Last Supper bread and wine meal from? Where did he get his idea of preaching using sermon? Well, we mentioned yesterday how a lot of his sermons paralleled those of Buddha, didn't they? But the initial idea of using allegory came from the Therapeutae. They trained him from the time he was a kid. Later, when he journeyed to India, he got impressed hearing about some of these allegories of Buddha. Hey, he's got some great ideas. I'm going to use some of his storylines. I was planning on, you know, preaching using parables anyway, but I like this guy's. My God, is it obvious? Jesus' mission wasn't so divine after all, now, was it? Oh, Bible dupes. Will it ever happen? Will there ever come a day when we'll be freed from this frickin' outmoded, outdated, absolutely ridiculous nonsense? We can only hope. But I don't have too much hope in that direction. I don't see it happening, guys. You could burn every Bible out there, and Bible dupes are still going to be telling these fairy tales. They'll be mutated completely in coming years, but they'll still be clinging to that faith in one form or another. And by the way, that's exactly what has happened, in spite of the fact that you've got scriptures, you know, the story written down. It still has mutated over and over and over and over and over again, so much so that today's Christianity, forget the fact that there's so many different denominations, no two can agree on anything, even though they have the same book in hand. Even if all Christian churches today were all in agreement and all following the same book, that book doesn't agree with its own self. It's been mutated so many freaking times. Nobody knows. Nobody even knows that Jesus really did exist. But like I said, I'll give him that. Let's give him that. Jesus existed. But you don't know what the hell he did, what he said. You don't know. There's been so many changes, and the thing is so damn contradictory. But that doesn't stop multiplied millions upon millions upon millions of people from reading it every day and insisting that it's absolutely infallible and following it to the T, or at least believing they follow it to the T, but nobody can because it contradicts itself. How can you follow something to the T that it isn't consistent? One section of my book, guys, coming out deals with doctrinal inconsistencies, or should I say major contradictions. Major doctrinal contradictions. A lot of Bible dupes who agree that there's mistakes and errors and contradictions of the Bible, they'll say, well, they're not major ones. They're not issues of salvation. Oh, yes, they are. In fact, the doctrine of salvation is one of the major doctrinal contradictions. The Bible can't even get that straight. How are we saved? Is it by faith? Is it by works? Is it by keeping the law? Is it by loving your neighbor? Is it by getting baptized? And when do we know we're saved? Do we lay claim to it from the day that we first came to Jesus? Is it something that's ongoing? Is it something that we won't know until the future, until Jesus comes? We can't have assurance now, but we can only hope. Is it a decision we even make for ourselves, or is it something that's already been predetermined? Holy horse crap! The contradictions aren't major and don't affect salvation. Oh, yes, they do. They are major. They do affect your belief about salvation. Whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. So, like I said, guys, the book obviously is not going to be ready in time for my final show next Friday, final for now, anyway. But like I said, keep in touch. A listener asked me, in fact, I had a couple listeners ask me, oh, keep my email in mind, let me know. You know what, I got too many things on my plate, too many people asking me stuff like that. I really can't do that. So just, you know, drop me an email like mid to late April or something. Ask for an update and, you know, I'll send it to you then. I've already sent it to a couple people that have asked in its currently mutilated form. You know, it's not ready yet, but yeah, you know, why not? In fact, I've asked, I asked one of the people to let me know if, you know, if you see anything in there you think needs changing, more, better clarification or whatever, you know, to let me know. So it's kind of like an assisted proofreader thing. But if you want it when it's finally ready, just drop me an email. Let me, you know, mid to late April or something. I can send it to you then. Should be actually up on Amazon, hopefully sometime in May or June at the latest. I guess, like I said, you know, probably won't be able to be editing it on the scale that I've been hoping for because I got to start working on getting some more money coming. But anyway. Once I can get that all worked out, if I have some free time, I want to, my goal is to write another book too, guys. I've been talking about this for a while. I want to do a book on the history of the tribe's crimes down to the centuries. That's going to be a really hard task because how do you limit that within 500, 600, 700 pages? You know, it's going to be a real challenge, but I want to cover the whole damn thing right from the word go. From ancient Egypt right on up into modern times. Can't cover everything, but, you know, all the major highlight points, just so people can see, my God, I missed the elephant in the living room. That type of thing. So, yeah, that's my next project. Anyway, that's all the time for today. I'm hoping to finish these notes up tomorrow and then be off onto several other things I want to cover for, you know, next Friday. Try not to ramble too much tomorrow. Finish this up. But very interesting stuff, guys. These journeys into ship. Pick up on this tomorrow. See you then, folks. Take care.